Crouch. Bind. Set.
Joe presents the House of Rugby, together with Guinness.
Hello, everybody. Away we go with a new edition of House of Rugby, brought to you by Joe, together with our very good friends. Guinness, our penultimate show, would you believe, for this series. My name is Alex Payne. It's a pleasure to have Lord Hoffington's back, present and correct. It's a welcome back to an old friend in the Leicester Tigers and England prop, Ellis Genge. How are you?
Yeah, good, man. What's going on?
Well, that's the question we're going to ask you, because I think there's a fair amount going on right now. We were going to be joined by Tins, but sadly he's doled up to the nines because he'd forgotten he's going to Royal Ascot. So,
whipped to the kidneys.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what he's doing, really. I don't know whether he's just dressed up and stayed home or whether he's actually gone. I don't know what he's doing.
He can't look as good as Ellis does. He looks like an angry 15-year-old teenager sitting in his nan's basement playing video games. I love that. I love that.
Can we just say, actually, we had Nigel Owens on the other day who looked like he was sort of in control of a little Cessna aeroplane. You have come with the dog's bollocks tonight. Those are Formula Ones. Run us through the setup. This is a professional gamer we're talking to.
Yeah, I've got some decent specs now. As of the other day, I had absolutely Terry hair set up. I spunked out some cash and I got a decent little operation going on. So,
are you sponsored yet? Or are you working towards that?
I was sent a few bits and bobs, but people keep getting pissed off me because I'm not putting up enough stuff, apparently. I'm just like, what the fuck do you want me to do? Send like a selfie of me with my headphones on? I'm just not about that. I would if you make it worth my while, but like, if you're sending me £150 pair of headphones, I'd rather go fucking buy them myself.
Is it time versus reward? You know, 150 sheets, that's obviously a lot, you know, it's a lot of money, but actually, you know, your value online. What do you want for £150 pair of headphones? Like, you know, cut your kidney out or something. It's like, come on. He's got time. He's building empires. He's building rivals to the RPA. he's a political man. He's a Black Lives Matter activist. He can't be dealing with plugging himself with headphones. He's not Cowan Dickey. He's got a life to lead.
He's also got a Batman chair, which I'm very jealous of. Well, I've got a little high-performance office number. Talk us through the Batman chair.
Alex, we said that to him earlier. He said, listen, Alex, it's not fucking Batman. It's the Dark Knight chair. Come on, Batman's for kids. This kid is, sorry, this representative is, you know, serious man. He's having high-level meetings in his Dark Knight chair with his landing gear down.
Do you know what's fucking brilliant, mate? I have been sat in this chair every single one of them. Close.
I just tried to recline in what was a wooden chair and I just heard it creak. And Chloe's off screen and she's just panicked.
Wait,
there we are. Steady.
So go on, hit us, Ellis. What's the breaking news? Are you back in your boots and your jock strap and jogging round, or are you still sort of taking it easy?
Yeah, they still haven't made a jock strap big enough for me yet, but boots are back on. Nah, mate, we came in, what day is this day? Tuesday. So came in on Monday, Bronco, running, social distancing at all times. It's a bit weird, isn't it? Because you sort of walk in, you want to get... and out a few ass slaps, but you can't really do all that sort of stuff now. So it's very much so. Boys are sort of taking the elbow approach, the old no pointing. Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? Because you're so used to, yeah, exactly. You're so used to being quite personal with the boys, and you come to the club and it's sort of your getaway and have a load of crack and that. But not much going on. It's just in, get flogged and disperse.
I think just on that with the handshakes, I think, you know, Ellis, you know, obviously we talked about it last time when he came on the show that it was a breath of fresh air and a different useful approach. Obviously in rugby, there is a merging of senior blazer wearing, red wine set up, you know, kind of people versus this new coming. And where they come together, there is a situation where you have a handshake, fist bump, a high five, a fan over the top. And that causes so much problems. Like, there's nothing worse than going and meeting a 65-year-old bloke in a blazer and he goes, "Hass boy." And you're like, "Whoa, listen, there's an age limit on that. You don't know me. We're not mates and we can't do that." So I then go like that. He then panics, goes to the handshake. You then go for the hug and you end up with a fist in someone's body. So I think due to quarantine, that will stop any fans like going, "Bro, how are you, bro? I'm not your bro, mate." Just wind it in. A handshake was perfect. A hug for good friends. Now everybody just knows. And I think that's quite a good leveler, personally.
It's good. A Space Invaders' worst nightmare, this, isn't it?
Oh, mate, yes. Honestly, I got a bloke today at the garage filling me up and he was like, sorry. Hey, lad. He paid for my fuel, so, you know, fair enough. You know, that, and we had that today and he went, and I was like, bro, it's COVID, mate. I ain't shaking your hand. Like, so just step back. Yeah. We'll do a distance photo and we'll just roll on.
How was the Bronco? What's it like being back under the whipping stick?
Yeah, it's good, mate. I quite like structure, weirdly enough, although I stay up to all sorts of times gaming and that. Coming back in sort of highlighted probably why I shouldn't be doing that now at my ripe age of 25. Bronco is tough, mate, as always. It's not my area that I excel in, let's say that. Some of the boys were in mental shape. I actually couldn't believe it. Like, what the fuck have you been doing? Like,
who's ripping up trees?
I don't want to tell you because he'd love it. If I told you, he would love it. I can't.
I don't want to know. In that case, no, I don't want to know.
Genuine, but I'm not telling you. But I didn't do too well, that's all you need to know. My back is quite, what's the word, temperamental, as Hass knows. I struggle to sort of get through those, not long fitness sessions, but any sort of turns and that really fuck about my SRJs. So, yeah, it's not my thing, really. But we live and we learn, and hopefully I get better.
I'm sure
you can't even keep it straight.
You've got masses of time. Yeah.
I'm trying very hard, genuine. I got to the end of the session. I might not finish first, but I won't start. That's the attitude.
Are either of you in the slightest bit interested in the fact that Super Rugby's back and being played in front of crowds, or has that passed you both by?
Yeah, to a degree. Obviously, it shows like return of normality to civilization to a degree. Obviously, they handle it a lot better than us, didn't they? I don't know, because now everyone's watching Super Rugby. They compare us to Super Rugby, do you know what I mean? They're like, fucking hell, the Prem's so shit. Everyone's so slow and be more like him. And it's just like, cut off, boys, relax. Watch that if you want. It's 6 o'clock in the morning every day.
Yeah, but that's been the chat for the entirety of my rugby career. Over in New Zealand, they're playing a magical sport that we can't understand, mate. They're doing stuff. If you look at the try, they passed the ball down the end of the line and the bloke gassed it into the thing and they're like, that's a miracle. They went, no, obviously the space and time was great and the handling was great and the fact that you got a hooker with absolute wheels. But, you know, I'd be like, I wonder how much quicker you'd be than you, Ellis. I mean, I know the spine goes with the... at some point, but I've seen that acceleration, especially with me shouting at you. But I actually watched it, Alex. I saw part of the highlights. I love Bowden Barrett getting involved. Love Dan Carter and Tana Munger as the Water Boys to end all Water Boys. Those two were absolute bin juice on the weekend. It's great to see two legends of the game reduced to nothing. You know, just sitting on there chatting, you know, people pleasers. I thought Dane Coles' wheels were exceptional. Mm. The rest of the game, yeah, it was great. Did I watch it from the... No, because I can't be asked out that early. But, you know, well done, New Zealand. Keep doing what you do.
Agree.
Do you think we can now, actually, given what you've just said, we could get a T-shirt made with Team Binjuice with Carter as the main man?
I hope so. Or maybe Carter got, like, in a headlock.
Louis Vuitton, though.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. Let's get a Louis Vuitton Binjuice T-shirt with Carter as the main man.
That'll float.
I'm in for one of those. A couple of other bits and bobs. Are we disappointed the game can't seem to get out of its own way when it comes to this calendar change and aligning the Northern and the Southern Hemispheres? Or is it just what it is? Are we getting there? Are we making any progress? Or are we still going around the same roundabout that we have been for the last 15 years?
Look, I've had a few chats with people involved in those discussions. I don't know how many players have been sort of contacted directly, because you'd think if you were sort of reconstructing or reshaping a game as to when people play the sport, you'd sort of think, right, well, ask the players their opinion and see what they want to do. But it also always sort of seems to be the people who are in those roles at the top just think, you know what, fuck it, we'll make them play then. They can have this time off, as opposed to actually sort of mediating with the people who are concerned, you know?
Are we going to get to the point we all want to get to, Hask, or is it just a pipe dream?
I'm waiting, because at the moment we're just doing a little bit of a tap dance. We're doing a little special souse around some of the issues before we pull the pin and absolutely lob the grenade in. But I will say, I am not a great example, because, you know, I've always been like Marmite, and people think I'm thicker than a tyre, so it doesn't help. But I've never been involved in any of those discussions with anything. I don't think... You asked me about Bill Beaumont's, you know, re-election. Legend of the game, lovely bloke, amazing England player, top man. Does his reinstatement make any difference to us as players? No, I don't know what they do and I don't know how it works. All I do is get told, or when I played, this is what you're going to go and do. Everybody has sat down and said, we need to find a new universal calendar. We want to make changes. I don't think we're going to get anywhere. And if what we're going to talk about in a minute is any indication, this is just never going to happen. The players play absolutely no role in any decision-making. No rule formalisation, no season balance, no rest, no structure. The only time I've ever been consulted or had any impact or anything was when I renegotiated the EPS contract with Dylan and the RFU 5-6 years ago. It was a reasonable process, but there were still things that were like, that's never going to happen. You can't ask for that. And I was like, well, why can't you ask for that? Well, you just don't ask. You're like, well,
it's not the way things run around here.
What were you asking for that you didn't get?
So I said things like, the people in sport at the moment, in this current climate, I want to be very clear. People are losing their lives. People are losing their livelihoods. And taking pay cuts and reducing money and everything else that is important to keep the game we survive. Playing for England has never been about what you've been paid. It's been about playing for the shirt and the honour. However, when you are a business, and this is what fans, people forget, they get so emotional about, you know, commitment, they forget it's a business. When it's a business and you're being commercially sold as a team, as individuals, for appearances and everything else like that, and the demand on you is such, you need to be remunerated for your time, because being a professional rugby player for England is not about turning up for training camp. It's signing 7,000 shirts. It's doing appearances with 40 different sponsors, you know, 10 times during a training camp. It's going off and doing business meetings with people. It's being used in advertisements at train stations, whatever. It's a full encompassing thing. So you need to be rewarded for the work you do. But what was important and things we were talking about were things like getting rest periods enshrined in a contract. So meaning that when you finish the Six Nations, that within 3 weeks of finish the Six Nations, you had to have a week off. Right. And that wasn't at the club's discretion, because as we're going to come on to later, the clubs do what the fuck they want and they don't care regardless about the players. So it's whatever matters to them. So if I finish Six Nations and I'm knackered, I played all five games, but I come back and Wasps are playing or Northampton are playing Leicester in a local derby, my coach is going to say, listen, we need you. Well, actually, mentally, I'm not. Eddie has driven me and the stand is up to here. The Premiership, its pace is down here. My body's wrecked. We've just won. We've been through an emotional battle. Am I in the best state to play? No. Should the decision be taken out of my hand? Yes. But no, but you play, you wouldn't, you go and play the game because it's the right thing to do because we're good people. And, you know, what you need to do is have that documentation in there. It was things like saying, right, you know, we would like to not worry about a cap on game, but it's like the level of training. It was the access that the team had to us. It was things like when players come away for a World Cup camp and they spend 9 weeks training and then they get fucked off out the back of it and they've given up 9 weeks, that they get paid to take part in some of that training because they're losing or they weren't getting a wage. And back in the day, certain clubs used to take half your England money and then not pay you for the time. And it was like the clubs would be earning money off the back of you. That wasn't that long ago.
Back in the day.
So back in the day, certain clubs would go, right.
Is that still happening, Ellis?
Yeah. Like, I think Leicester were quite notorious for it, weren't they? Like, well, it's definitely in my contract that I lost some of my money when I went away with England. To be honest, I actually agree with it in some regards, because like, you're not there at the club playing for them. So I understand the sort of incentive for the club to put that into your contract. I think it's been eradicated now because they sort of see that if you have England players playing for your club, it's a benefit for the club. And they get money, I think. Or actually, no, it's been spread amongst all the clubs now, hasn't it?
But they still, essentially, you know, the club, and obviously they tried to make it fair again because they're all in it together. But essentially, the point was that you would get paid, say, 170 grand per England player for that time, spread out between the clubs. But it would still equate to a large amount of money. There was at one point, they were going to make more money earning for me playing for England than I was getting paid by my club. And I pointed out to them, go, just pay me what England's paying you. They're like, no. So it's just stuff like that has just gone on for such a bizarre period of time. And you know, with the EPS, that's what we wanted to get. Actually, it's got into a really good place. And I think now the guys, I know people like Sinks and Ellis and some other boys are much more actively involved in, and Eddie understands more so than anything the importance of A, having access over the players and control of what they do. But for such a long time, that's been going on.
Fascinating. And I was going to do a menu of what's coming up, but we're right into the detail of it. So let's keep going. Ellis, it was interesting there. The thing I want to pick up on that James said is the fact that no players have a voice in the decision-making around the game at the moment. Now, this is obviously something you have explored, you've gone into. Can you just give us a bit of an update on what you were doing, why you were doing it, who you were doing it with, and where you're at with, you know, the project that you were starting? Was it back in March?
Yeah, well, there was talks of it a long time before that. I think even Hash sort of delved into it beforehand, like years and years ago. So when I first started to surface and sort of rumours came about, you gave me a ring, didn't you, and said, mate, you think it's brilliant, let me know how I can help, which was great. And like so many people, I won't name names because they might not want to be included. I'm not sure, I haven't spoke to many people about it, but for privacy reasons, we'll keep names to a minimum. Yeah, when it sort of started up, I had so many people supporting me saying, yeah, great idea. And they were saying the game's so hungry for it. Players like messaging me randomly that I haven't spoken to for years saying, what's going on? Champ players messaging me. Some of the women's rugby players messaging me. Like, so it was obviously a hunger for it, which I knew there was, but I wasn't aware of how desperate people were to sort of have this. At the beginning, we didn't actually sort of have the idea to be a union. It was more so, the idea was more sort of like a service to be represented commercially. And everyone was saying, oh, Ellis can just start an agency. It was never an agency. I'm not fucking going out there recruiting people from Nat Free who are 18 years old. It's not what I want to do by any means. I didn't ever want to make any money off of it. But obviously with a union like the RPF, I think you pay £180 a year maybe, Hask, is it?
Yeah.
So you pay £180 a year for the RPA as a senior player. So obviously any independent union, obviously the RPA are funded by RFU, PRL, so they're not entirely independent. Any independent union needs to be self-sufficient. So what we sort of came up with, me and one of my friends, was sort of an investment vehicle where you can put money in, and then because people don't get paid enough in rugby, so they don't want to lose their money. So they want their money back. That was my sort of idea behind it. Well, my friend's idea. He's a lot smarter than me. People put their money in. I think it was 1% of your salary a year, which has just come back out, which actually, no, this was the very first model we came up with. I don't understand why it surfaced again. We got rid of that months and months ago. It was put 1% of your salary in a year, so it's fair for everyone. And in, I think, 10 years' time, if you're like 23 or whatever, in 10 years when you're about to retire, you'll get your money back. But people thought, right, well, when I retire, I'm not going to be able to afford putting in 1% of my salary. You didn't have to put in 1% of your salary after you retire. It was just whilst you were playing. But you still get the money back. It was sort of like a, dare I say it, pyramid set of people at the bottom putting it in, and then when you retire, you get the money back. But we became aware very quickly that sounds a bit sort of sly and shady. So we scrapped that completely because people didn't trust us. And I thought, you know what, fair enough. It's absolutely our bad. We didn't think it through. So we went away and we went on a subscription basis. We actually tried to make it free, but then that would have meant other people helping us out and it wouldn't have been independent. So we sort of steered away from that. Sorry to bore you with the finances.
No, it's very interesting. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and then we sort of thought, right, fuck it. We're not going to copy the RPA because you won't be able to survive on £180 from each player in the Premiership a year. So we sort of bolstered it up to, I think it was £500 or maybe £400 in the end for senior boys, £200 for academy boys. Then we looked at, do you think you can sort of subsidise it by the clubs making this part of their programme to sort of help academy boys by paying their fees? And then we thought, actually, no, because then the clubs would be like, right, well, we pay your fees, so we're going to have a say and we want to know the newsletters and all that sort of stuff. So there was a lot of speculation around, oh, Genji's trying to make a quick quid, and that was never my intentions. Yeah, mate, I have people genuinely asking some of the boys, like, well, what's in it for Genji? Fucking nothing, actually. I really don't want to do it. Do it yourself. Do you know what I mean?
Instead of Bernie Madoff, we've got Ellis Madoff with the ultimate pyramid scheme. Yeah. Walks off with a billion quid.
I wish, Bab. I wouldn't be on this call now.
hey, do you know what I mean? What are you talking about? Yes, you would. Yes, you would.
Boy, you'd be DJing for me on Twitch.
I'm available. I'm unemployed. Yeah. I'm available.
Absolutely available. So, yeah, that was sort of the financials of it. And boys were still very confused about it. I didn't know how more simple we could make it. So put £500 in, you're going to be a part of this union moving forward. But anyway, sorry. So going back to how it started off, yeah, at first it was sort of a service to help people because people were so poorly sort of looked after during this COVID stuff. It was like, right, bang, this is what's happening here. Boom, message coming out. This happens. All of a sudden, people know what furlough means and people don't know what it means. And when you come back to work after furlough, I was told by someone who works in a business world, it's weird because every time something happens in the business world and then sort of correlates into sports or rugby, well, just rugby, actually, I've not been involved in any other sport, into a rugby world, it suddenly becomes different. The meaning becomes different. So I was told by one of my friends who owns a business, mate, when you put someone on furlough and they're on a contract, so a fixed term contract, like a playing contract or a clean or anything like that, you don't have to re-employ them at the end of the contract. So maybe I'm wrong, but this is what my friend told me. So I was going to tell the boys just in case it was true. So I told the lads, look, at the end of your furlough terms, you don't have to be re-employed. So just be very careful of what you agree to. And then all of a sudden, I'm fucking telling lies and trying to make everyone abandon the club. And I was like, fucking hell, look, I love Leicester. You've looked after me so well. It's a great club. I want to be a part of it. I like our shareholders. Like, I speak to them regularly. Peter Tom, hell of a boy. And all of a sudden, this was sort of feeding back to them as if I was like leading a, what's the word?
Revolution.
Rebellion.
I'm a bit of a rebel, legend. But as if I was leading like a revolution fucking against Leicester. And I was like, this ain't what I'm trying to do at all. This is new for everyone. I don't know what fucking furlough means. It sounds like a French sandwich of some sort. Like, I'll have a furlough with cheese, please. But that was how it sort of started. I thought, right, fuck it. This is the time to sort of put this into play. So then after we sort of got over the service side of things, because that was the quickest way to get up and running. We didn't need any signatures. It was going to be, right, we've got it here. If you want to use it, carry on. So it quickly sort of developed into this union. Then I had the RPA on my case ringing me up saying, what's this about you starting a union? And I was like, I've literally told my nan, my mum, my dad about this. How the fuck do you know? Like, it spread like wildfire. Obviously, I told a few more people than that, but it was very much so in construction, if you will. Nothing was set in stone. We didn't know what we were going to do in the end, but what I knew is that people weren't getting the right advice. I think rugby as a whole can be commercialised a lot better anyway, so that was what I wanted to allude to in the beginning. So we went down that route of the union. So what I did was got with some very clever people, again, a lot smarter than me, and we sort of started putting together something called Survey Monkey. It's basically an online survey creation thing. Started getting signatures, putting this like PowerPoint together, and everything you ever send out, of course, you're going to get feedback, and boys aren't going to like certain bits. But everything we sent out, boys were like, nah, fuck that. Don't agree with that. Don't agree with this. So it was a bit of a disaster in the beginning. Obviously, it's quite disheartening. When you're trying to do something for free off your own back, you're not getting paid for it. You've got a lot of time, of course. Not everything's about money. I'm aware of that. But when you get paid for something, sometimes a bit more of an incentive, isn't it? So you're doing it off your own back. This bloke that I'm working with is doing it for free. He doesn't want any money off us. We just paid to set up like the websites and the surveys and all that jazz. Anyway, we started like, I'm going to cut it long and short. I was beer all night speaking about it. But we basically pinged out these surveys, and I think we got like 128 people back. I sent it to basically people at the clubs who I thought, right, they'll push the message out and all the boys would jump in. And it took less than three minutes to do this survey. Honestly, I'll show you after. It was so quick to do the survey. And it was basically to collect all the data we needed to go to the PRL and speak to them about the situation that we were in when clubs started breaching contracts and sort of slashing boys' wages willy-nilly and saying, we're not going to pay you until this happens. And mate, loads of mental shit happening that we weren't educated on. So what do you expect? If anytime you get in trouble, you go and find the lawyer, don't you? Or you might not. You might speak to someone else. But if you get involved with the police, any sort of authority, someone above you in terms of power, you got to go find a lawyer. You need to be best represented. So we sort of looked for legal advice. And we found a very good bloke, who, again, I won't say his name, brilliant at his job. So we found legal advice in the club, again, took that to offence. And we thought, fuck me, we can't do anything right here. But we stuck with it, stuck at our guns, and he started to get involved in the union and helping us out with that. And it was all sort of forming together very nicely. But then obviously when you sort of seek out a lawyer, people think, right, this is getting very serious. When it wasn't that at all, we were just trying to sort of protect our rights in terms of, like, you don't want to get stitched up, you don't know what's going on. So you just want to say, look, I want to get paid fully if the opportunity arises. And at the time, obviously there was a lot. I say this was about a month ago, maybe a month and a half ago, but there was a lot of stuff going on in the world where you thought, fucking hell, this is way more important than me getting my full pay pack. So we sort of took a back seat with that in terms of we didn't want to force it too much. But then like another random email would come out from someone saying, this is happening now and you have to do this. And we were like, fuck me, we got to batten down the hatches here and just be clued up on everything. But yeah, so we sent out these surveys, very well put together, I thought. And I sent out to all these boys who I thought, right, yeah, boys will get behind this. And sent to the whole premiership, I thought. And we got 128 signatures back, which obviously, out of, I don't know how many people's in the premiership, 800, 900? It's not a lot. What's that, 17% maybe? So we were, again, not upset, but just thought, fuck me, like, what are we doing? We're wasting our time here. It's clearly a massive need for it because of all the phone calls we've had and all the people we've had approach us and everyone who wants to get involved and the sort of backing that it got. But then, like, we only got 128 people fill this survey out for us to collect the data. And this was the day before we were having our phone call with the PRL. And we spoke to the PRL, not as players. We weren't representing anyone at the time. We just wanted to say, look, we've got a fair bit of data saying that, like, we want to be represented better in these tough times for everyone. So we spoke to the PRL and we were still quite hopeful about the union. But then when it sort of boiled down to it, we just thought, fuck me, there is absolutely no room for any sort of independent union here. Like, there's just the way it's set up, there is just no way for players, like James said, sorry, going back to your original question about the players' voice. although I've waffled on for fucking ages, there is no room for an independent voice. It's not plausible. You can't nestle your way in there and change this and change that. It's literally, like he said, there's so many hurdles to jump over. You have to give a mile and you get an inch, you know? Like, it's mad, mate. We just don't have any power. And, like, sort of Haas sort of drilled into me sort of when we come into the setup, he was all saying, players have the power, players have the power. And I thought, yeah, you know what, we fucking do. Because if we don't play, there's no game and that. But it runs a lot deeper than that. And I'm aware about the grassroots stuff, funding the game and everyone, the fans who love it. But like you said, when it becomes business and you're getting everything taken away from you and it's a breach of your rights and all that sort of stuff and you're not being spoken to about it, it becomes quite personal and you want to sort of do something about it. So that was sort of our aim for it, the union, to sort of help everyone out during pressing times. And yeah, it just become an absolute U-turn. And to be honest with you, it's sort of dampened the proceedings. Like, we're probably not going to go ahead with it, and not because we didn't want to, mate. Fuck me, we spent a lot of time on this, and I mean a lot of time, and there's some good people worked on it. I thought it was very, very good sort of idea, and everyone else did by the sounds of things. But yeah, with the players, like, in 2 years time, if boys turn around and say, fucking hell, they took 25% of our wages, we couldn't do anything back, well, you could have, you just didn't want to. 128 people did, but the rest of them didn't, and maybe they didn't hear about it. I'm not too sure, but the data we received was very sort of, it fell very short of the line, should I say. So yeah, it's not happening at the moment. If we find an opportunity to sort of kickstart it again, then we will, but for the time being, it's become very much so right, you have to deal with your club independently. So that's what I think boys are doing at the moment.
Are you baffled, disillusioned, furious, or just disenfranchised on the whole thing?
I said it to my dad. I said, look, I understand there's a load of mental shit going on in the world, and it's crazy at the moment, and some serious, serious things going on. And you got to take time to appreciate that. But I said to my dad, he's a plumber, and I said, if I told you, right, Rich, do this bathroom, and you finish it, and I said, I'm going to give you 25% less than what we originally agreed, I said, what would you do? Do you know what I mean? And his answer was, well, I wouldn't fucking do you another bathroom. So, and I listen to old man, although he's not the sharpest tool in the box, he gives good advice. So, I don't know, everyone has to make some big decisions, I guess. And obviously it's so tricky. Like, I'm trying not to sit here. I'm not trying to slag the club off. As I said, I love Leicester, everything about it. But when it becomes like this, it's ugly for everyone involved. And we're trying to sort of mediate with the club and get out of it on the other side. Yeah, that's all I got for you at the moment.
Can I ask something? You know, I actually...
You ask whatever you like, James.
Thank you, Ellis. As I, Bernie Madoff, I called you up beforehand, and I actually called you up because I missed your call and you were a bit irate. I didn't come back to you because you thought I was darking you. And I called you up and you said...
You told me to ring you. I rang you and you didn't answer. Yeah,
busy man, mate, busy man. And I said to you, what you're doing? And you said, I'm on a call with a PRL, right? So, you know, when you and I had this discussion, I want to make this very clear, and we're going to clear up some of this stuff. I think the RPA and what they're allowed to do a very good job. I think they are completely and utterly ignored by the clubs. I don't think they're taken seriously by the PRL. And I think they're the last to know about everything, because they're just, from what I spoke to, when I spoke to Ellis, I spoke to him on the phone call and I talked to him about the, you know, the RPA or whatever they were going to call it. And I said to him, listen, there is a lot of desire to have a proper representative body, not the RPA that represent us, but something with real nuts and bolts onto it, something that with a real power. If you control the players and everything else like that, you control that. Not to become a trade unionist, not that I want a revolution or striking, but I believe that there were lots of things that go on in the game with individual clubs, the way players are treated, some of the contract negotiations, some of the Wild West behaviour, some of the unprofessional way that players leave clubs, sign to clubs, players are treated through injury. There was a lot of that going on. Right, there was a lot of that going on. I know stories left, right, and centre without throwing people under the bus. So when I spoke to Ellis, I said, Ellis, I think it's brilliant. I actually understood the financial stuff of maybe unlocking some more money and actually having proper, meaningful negotiations with the clubs about image rights, usage. You know, I thought there was something there that actually, you know, the merging of the RPA and something else like that to give a bit more teeth was, I thought, you know, a really good idea. And Ellis has always maintained that it was an accessory to that. I called him back after the PRL call. And Ellis was like a completely different bloke. The version I got back from you was that the clubs decide what they want to do, when they want to do it. They make the rules whenever they want, and there's absolutely nothing anyone can do. And it doesn't matter if I set up an independent body, everything is structured to favour the clubs and the way they do things. Is that basically the upshot of it?
To a degree, yeah. When we spoke to PRL. Mate, the people we spoke to, Phil Winstanley and I think it's Darren Childs, is it?
Darren Childs, the chief exec.
Mate, lovely blokes, to be fair, and I'm not usually a big fan of those sort of business types of people, but they were actually lovely blokes. They're very straight with us, gave us all the information we needed. And again, I'm not the most educated bloke, but what I sort of took from it is, firstly, all the clubs are shareholders in PRL. And obviously, you always got to keep shareholders happy, haven't you? To a certain degree, I guess. And yeah, they make 95% of the decisions. The thing that sort of deflated me is I've obviously been so amped up for this sort of union that we'd set up. And again, like I said, I think the RPA are very good at what they do. Welfare and that, some legends working with the RPA, Mike McCarthy. But they weren't making any headway with it. So we went to speak to them. And yeah, like I said, at the end of the call, which I thought was going to be the fucking breakthrough moment, we asked this last question. I can't remember it word for word, but it was basically, it alluded to, is there much point of us setting up this union? And they were like, well, you got to take that up with the clubs. And as soon as they said that, we both sort of like, although it was on Zoom or whatever, but me and Bateman looked at each other and we were like, fucking hell, like, why have we worked this hard to wait for that answer? Why couldn't we have just been told that at the beginning? If we knew that we had to work with the club, then why have they sort of been saying that it was PRL's decisions? And do you know what I mean? It was never sort of, it was like, oh, well, these guys are doing this and all the other clubs are making these cuts, so we have to do it. And PRL are enforcing a reduced salary cap, so we have to do it. And I said to PRL, the boys on the call, I said, you're forcing the club's hands making these cuts because you're lowering the salary cap. And they said, no. Then I found out, obviously, the June the 16th or 18th, if you sign before then, you only count towards 75% of the cap, which I thought, fucking hell, it's a good idea. But aren't you making like a massive deal about this if everyone signs before the 18th and they only count towards 75% of the cap, but you're reducing the cap by 25%. What's the fucking point in reducing the cap? Because everyone could just sign their players up for 75% only counting. So do you know what I mean? If Alex, you probably bought, get 100 pound a year. So if you signed up for 100 quid, only 75 pound of that will go into the cap for people who watch this and won't understand what I'm saying. So you can still get paid 100 pounds to the club's discretion. They don't have to. We were like, why the fuck are you doing it then? Yeah. And there was all sorts of reasons that got written down somewhere, but I wasn't taking many notes. You can imagine I had steam coming up my ears still. Yeah, so it was very confusing as to why we sort of got led to believe that everything was coming from the PRL, when really you just had to go to your club and speak to them, which is a whole nother story.
I'm conscious that there is a lot of detail flying around, and a lot of this, as you mentioned, is the fact the salary cap is coming down to 5 million, and then I think it's going to go back up again in 2023-24. That is forcing the club's hands. There was a very interesting article today, which is the new agreement between the RFU and the players is going to be substantially less, I think, than the one you negotiated last time, Hask. The money just isn't there at Twickenham to pay what they have been paying. You mentioned the fact that the contracts that need to be renegotiated before, or re-signed before June the 18th, as it is, will only count to 75%. There are real knock-on effects with that, though, aren't there, James? I mean, we may well end up with the clubs that move fastest and therefore retain their stars playing at a very different playing field to those who say, brilliant, it's 25% across the board.
I've obviously followed parts of this. So I've been seeing it from Ellis's point of view as a player, but I've also, you know, I obviously work with the RPA and I speak to them, and I think, you know, I feel very sorry for the RPA, because what happens is I've got, you know, great relationship with clubs. All the stuff of these, my experiences, you know, obviously a secondhand information from guys. So I'm in certain WhatsApp groups seeing stuff. And what happens is the clubs don't call up the RPA, because this is how it should work, right? This is what we said. And Tins and I had a little bit of a loggerhead situation about 25%. My argument was not that it wasn't right to take 25% for the sustainability of the clubs during this lockdown period. We weren't playing, we weren't doing anything. It was the right thing to do. However, what should have happened was an open and honest dialogue. So what happened is the PRL should run the clubs, right? They should have a role, the PRL, because otherwise, I don't know what their role is. So they should have a role. They should manage the clubs. PRL should speak to the RPA and say, right, as a club set up, we would like to take 25% off the players. You need to go and speak to your player body and say, this is what's going on. That's not what happened. And that's where people lose it. What happens is one club goes, right, by the way, you're losing 25%. Sign this letter. Another club calls them all in and goes, by the way, we're thinking of reducing to 25%. Another club goes, look, we're going to take 25%, but we would want to pay that back. So you've got all these clubs, 12 clubs, doing whatever the fuck they like. RPA are like getting phone calls from players going, I've just had this piece of paper put in front of me. Can I sign it? They're like, well, what do you mean piece of paper? Well, the club wants to take 25%. Well, hold on a minute. Let's speak to that. And then the phone goes again and the phone goes again. And it's like a constant nightmare situation of catch up. And what's come out of it now is essentially, I'm just going to read something from what I was talking to someone today. It's because there is no uniform agreement with the clubs, and because the PRL do not govern the clubs, and because the RPA don't have any power over the clubs, is essentially why you wouldn't have another governing body. There is a situation where they've basically created a premiership with three or four teams with a 25% higher budget than the others. They've lowered the cap, and the first thing every team has done is given the top earners a contract extension. And then obviously other players are going to get so screwed by it. I've spoken to players today who have got 1 year left on their contract and have been told, if you sign to support this, we'll give you 3 years. But by the way, you're going to take 80 grand less than you're worth now, even if, because there's so much uncertainty. So we don't know when the game's going to come back. So it's a very scary time. So players can't even go, well, tomorrow I'm going to look at France, I'm going to look at everything else. So they're getting this situation where they're getting bullied into it. I've had other situations where I had a conversation today with somebody because I've called around and the club has turned around and said, we actually pay you through a separate business. If you don't agree to these contracts, we're going to liquidate the company and you'll all be unemployed and we'll re-sign you for that. Other clubs have had a conversation today where they've come in the morning, they've passed out contracts to everybody and says, you have until noon today to sign these contracts. If not, all bets are off, because everybody wants to shoehorn in before the 18th of June. So the argument is, if you're going to create something like that for the benefit of the game and you vote to do it and you don't consult any players, then you should have the contracts thing run up, you know, done by the close of play on the day you voted, and everything retains the same and you move forward like that. Or you have it in 6 months' time when we're back playing, we understand what the future of the game is. This is just capitalization on a difficult situation. And, you know, some clubs are in such different financial peril. And I completely agree with that. And there has to be some sort of reduction. There has to be some sort of discussion. I think Tins's point about a reduction of the salary cap to put less pressure on clubs, because I don't think exactly what Ellis says. Commercially, the clubs don't do things very well. I think the game is not as big as it could be. I think this coronavirus has obviously, you know, completely fucked the world. But the point is that there is no honest dialogue, reasonable discussion. Everything is done like the Wild West. And we're supposed to be a professional sport and held to the highest standards on the field. We spend all this money on nutritionists, GPS units, yet we run it like a Dutch auction where, you know, or whatever, where it's over a barrel. And that's what I have great issue with, because I just don't think it's fair and it's right. And it basically just shows who's in control of this game. And obviously the clubs pay the money, but you have to communicate with your players properly. You can't just bully some player into doing it. And also, but for some players, they're going to massively benefit. And it suddenly means that some guys are going to be completely fucked. You can't go on strike because obviously...
They'll terminate your contract.
Yes, because also what the clubs have done, and this is really important, is that if you deviate a contract, the contract becomes null and void. So if a club decides to deviate the contract and enforce something that wasn't written in your contract, the players have a cast iron contract. So within 6 years of the end of their contract, you could go to court and claim back any money that was taken. Right, that's the advice I've taken. You know, no doubt some keener will tell me I'm wrong, but that is what the general consensus from the RPA and other people is. So boys are in a strong situation, but it's very hard in an emotionally based sport, in a team sport, when you're pressured going by people that are scary, people in suits. You know, like Ellis said, people don't understand what furlough means. You suddenly, you know, people are getting furloughed. The RPA have to release a statement as to what furlough means. But the worst thing of all of this is that Ellis sends out a thing to 800 players and 150 or 120 players come back when this is their very future they're talking about. It's what I said in a podcast before. Sports people, myself more than anyone, are so selfish and so focused that you don't worry about, you know, a fire alarm in your house until your fucking house is burning down, right? And then you go, shit, I should have bought a fire extinguisher and a thing. All these lads are going to get the shock of their lives and are getting the shock of their lives. And all they had to do was respond and take an active interest. The RPA reps are flat out. They are literally tin hats on, bayonets fixed, going to war against the clubs every day. And they're not legal representatives. They don't understand what half the words are. And it's like a real bizarre situation. And it is showing the worst of rugby, the dynamic, who has the power. There is just absolutely no joined up thinking. And everything is done on an individual club by club basis.
That's the problem, Hass, is that for a decision to be made, every single Prem club has to align and think, yeah, that's a good idea. And it has to be a majority vote, doesn't it? I don't think it can be like 10 versus 2 or... You know, it has to be a majority vote, and the chances of that happening is slim and none. So as I said, it's just so hard to get anything done.
Do you mean unanimous? So everyone has to vote?
I think so, yeah, because like the salary cap cuts, I think, basically got voted against by Bristol, Exeter, and I think Bath, I'm not too sure. And the rest of the clubs were like, well, fucking hell, if they haven't done it, then we can't do it. And I was like, well, hold on a sec. You're treating everyone differently and individually when it comes to their contracts. But then suddenly when it becomes about the salary cap being reduced, it has to be a collective. Like, I just feel as though when the ball's in their court, obviously, isn't it? Like, they can do what they want, as we've found out. And I do think they're trying to look after the players. But at the same time, I sort of ask myself the question of, why wait for a fucking pandemic to look at how you can make the game more commercially attractive, more financially stable, and just make the game better in general? I don't understand why you'd wait for a pandemic for all these massive changes, because now we're hearing that the game needed to have the salary cap lowered anyway. And obviously with the furlough schemes, like, clubs aren't actually losing as much as everyone would think, because something like 8% of your wage up to $2,500, which doesn't cover everyone, but trust me, that'll cover a lot of professional rugby players. It's not all glamour what people get paid. Some boys earn a lot less than others, which is why it's so important that you look after the financial stability of those boys who earn a lot less. Because if I'm being perfectly honest, like, it ain't gonna fucking affect me too much. I earn decent work, so if they do cut the wage by 25%, I'll still have a decent income. It's the people who've literally fucking thrown all their eggs into one basket, and then they're like, right, 25% less, or it could be 50% less. They can do whatever they want, because they can literally end your contract at any time. You've seen it in the past, Tats. You've seen boys at your club, right, fuck it, we're getting rid of you. Bang, done. Well, I've got a contract with you, don't matter.
Can I ask, though, are you scared that you've put your head above the parapet and done this now? Because...
oh, mate, I'm fucking over it, to be honest, Ass. Like, if they want to get rid... If someone's get rid of me, I want to stay at Leicester, love the club. I've told them that. I'm behind them all the way. I don't agree with what they're doing, and they're very aware of that. I've been on the call with loads of people telling them that. Fucking really want to work for Steve. Alid, the new bloke that's coming, all the coaches, I think we're actually coming together now. It's going to be the new Leicester, you know? And it's fucking good to be a part of. It's exciting. But in the same breath, I put my head above water for everyone to sort of think, fucking hell, there really is something going on here. Maybe these boys are sort of not looked after as well as we think. And you sort of see rugby being played in front of 80,000 at Twickenham, and you think, fucking hell, well, to be fair, the England boys will all be on good work, except for Curry signed a 10-year deal at Sale. $2,000 a year.
No, wait, both of them, Steve Diamond with a gun to his head, going, lad, sign a 10-year for $4,000. All right, lads, I'm keen.
Gun in this hand, cigar in the other. But besides that, like, it's the other boys in the league that you think, these boys just ain't going to be all right. It's I've got so many mates, and again, I don't like mentioning names, I've got so many friends who are just fucked after rugby. You're working on, like, scaffolding sites. So I know a lot of the fucking people out there, welcome to the fucking real world. Well, no, mate, try coming up a fucking scaffold ladder with no cartilage in your knee from clearing out rucks for the last 10 years. It don't work like that, mate. Try sitting in the office chair. I'm sat in this chair, my back's in fucking agony today. I'm going to have to
get stretch. Because you're in the proper one.
Yeah. And then you hear about people talk about, oh, everyone's getting pay cuts at the club. Yeah, I'm perfectly aware that you're all getting pay cuts at the club, but you can work in a ticket office for 40 years. You hear about that. Well, this person's been in the ticket office for 40 years at this club. Fucking class. Some of my mates have only been there 3 years, and now they're fucked. Everyone sort of forgets about that. And I am all for everyone getting paid whole. I'm not just for the players getting paid whole. I think they all should. You have to understand how business works, and I'm not a fucking financial advisor. I'm clued up, but I'm not as smart as all the other people they've got employed, clearly. Again, otherwise I wouldn't be on this call. But you have to remember, mate, the careers are short. Your health's at risk, and it's just, yeah, like you said, it's a bit of a calamity. And to put my head sort of where I've put it, and everyone's be giving me heat about, oh, you're so fucking selfish, and I'm literally trying to do, like, the most selfless thing I can by, like, helping the boys out and sort of making people aware of what's going on. And I've absolute fucking double barrel put in my face. But like I said, mate, I'm whatever happens, I'm happy. I can sleep at night. I've done what I thought I needed to do. My mum was a bit sketchy about it as well, sort of said, Ellis, are you sure you should be doing this? Like, is this the right thing to do? Obviously, I was in the media quite a lot, and I got a lot of messages from people, and I said, you know what, mum, I'm happy. I'm trying to look after my mates and other people, so...
You do know that the way this situation works is that if when you go back and playing and something happens, you don't have a couple of good games or whatever, which happens to every player, that's what's going to be thrown back to you. And that happens to people who have character and who do things. And I honestly think you couldn't have put it more succinctly, that the point is that you can't put professional sport in a bracket of what's happening in different areas, because it's a completely different demand. It's a completely different thing. You know, I think it's very commendable to have done that. But, you know, I just think the awareness that people are going to throw stones and it's going to sometimes be difficult, but I think you've done the right thing.
Yeah, like you said then, like, boys are going to make comments and stuff. I think one of the boys said when my back went in the Bronco, one of the boys said, you spent too much time trying to set up a union as opposed to doing your Bronco, which is probably fucking right, really, isn't it? But like you said, people are throw stones, but I'm happy with where I'm at in terms of what I've tried to do. But yeah, it's just a bit deflating when you sort of find out something like that you've put so much time and effort into just can't sort of come through to fruition, so...
I will be honest, it is fascinating listening to the two of you talk. And, you know, we always try quite hard to be a balanced and fair book at the House of Rugby. And, you know, if people from the RPA, PRL, clubs want to come and have a write a reply, the shop door is very much open, so to speak. I just cannot believe that we are 25 years into professionalism and we're still going around this roundabout. And, you know, it's just so utterly deflating.
But don't you think, Alex, don't you think, though, if you had joined that bit of thinking, and the PRL hold the clubs to account, and there was honest dialogue, we would ultimately get to a unanimous decision, because rugby players are good people and they want to do the right thing for their clubs. They all love their clubs. You know, it's abundantly clear Ellis loves Leicester Tigers and wants the best for them. But also, you've got to consider players. And do you remember, our careers like that, we're a blink of an eye. Those clubs, hopefully, will still remain a long time. And one bad tackle, one bad earning, you're dust and nobody remembers you. And that's life. And I just think... some of those nuances get really forgotten.
I still wonder if someone somewhere is dusting off the Kerry Packer manifesto of 1995, where he went for the players and said, let's do something together and we'll make it what you want it to be. I wonder if there's a billionaire somewhere who fancies writing a cheque and playing the game. Very, very quickly, because we must take a mid-trail break. I was messaging one of the movers and shakers in this story earlier, who just said it's as bad as it's ever been. And, you know, they've been around the block and it's... there's a sort of impasse, everyone's shouting at each other. And I just wonder, Ellis, where it all ends up. I mean, do the players just shrug, end up going back to work and, you know, in August the 15th or whatever it is, we're all back watching rugby again and people are pissed off, but we're back? Or is there more to come?
Listen, I'm happy to go in, get my head down, train as hard as I can and be the best I can. That's sort of what we encourage the boys to do, is just, look, keep coming in, keep training, don't fuck anyone off. Don't give anyone a reason to sack you. Genuine. Do you know what I mean? You don't want to come out of this look on the bad end of it. And although it's shit already, you don't want to make it any worse. So I know as much as you, mate, in terms of that. I'm aware that we're supposed to be coming back on the 15th of August. Don't know if it's going to happen. I think it will. But then again, like, when the stadiums are full up, I don't know if we're going to get the dough back. It's not a deferral period. It's more so fucking... it's just gone. James, sorry, boy. One thing I wanted to go back to, sort of when you said with the RPA, no one sort of listens to him and that. The one thing that I think, not splintered, but sort of separated the boys from reading the emails anymore, was they sent out one, quote me on it if you will. I think it said, we fully support the clubs in this tough decision that had to be made. And obviously, when you've got a rugby players association, that was when the alarm bells started ringing for us, and we thought, fucking hell, why would you support the clubs when you're supposed to be representing the players? You should have nothing to do with the club's decision on that. You should be like, no fucking way. So that was when we sort of thought, well, fucking hell, there's a lot more going on here. That was what really sort of edged us into diving deeper into all of it. As if anyone's thinking that Genji's a fucking weirdo, why was he sat at home looking up all these accounts and finding out who ran what, this is why I did it, because some of the messages we were getting were just so miffed and I just couldn't get my head around them.
That's why I called you up, and I plainly say it, and I, you know, I've spoken to Hoppers, and, you know, we joked about Dills and I were going to set up a rival to the RPA. You know, if we could get $1 billion back, or we were going to do it. You know, we're going to have a gentleman's lounge, cigar lounge, barbers, lids, decent coffee, meetings rooms. Lid. You know, we're going to create something pretty special. But all jokes aside, I have said all along that how can you go and negotiate a deal with somebody and go to the fence with somebody that funds you ultimately? Because I'll give you an example. So I'm a rugby agent per se, right? And my client says to me, you go in and you tell Wasps that I want X amount of money. This is what I'm going to do and this is what I'm going to do, right? And so it comes back and there's all this delay. And then you get heated and you say, you fucking, listen, go in there, do your job. taking your 20%, make it happen. If as a player, you think your agent's going to go down, kicking the doors in, right, and start fighting for you, you do that once in one club and the club will refuse to deal with you. That's why in football, that's why in football, those blokes have, you know, Ronaldo has Ronaldo's bloke has two blokes that he makes his entire living off because he doesn't need to because he's got the best in the world and he can do what he wants. In rugby, the money and earning potential from these agents is a cumulative thing. They guarantee, you know, there isn't much massive commercial stuff. There is more now, but you know, the bread and butter for a rugby agent is your playing contract. So they ain't going to go in there and fucking kick doors in for you. They're going to go in, they'll play a bit of hardball, but they won't do it. I've always said about the RPA, I think they struggle to rally the players because the players don't pay enough attention, aren't invested. The RPA could not do more. I don't think we're trying to get the reps, but the reps become, you know, the guys just don't, if you don't engage the rep and you don't pay attention or fill in a form or question, you're not going to be involved. Like when I was captain of WAS, I used to sit in a meeting and go, right, lads, this is happening. If you've got any questions, tell me now. Ask anything. I'd leave the meeting. 10 minutes, I'd find two lads standing in the corner having a bitch. And I was like, lads, I just asked you to flag any concerns that you had. And they don't do it. And that's what sports people are like. And so I think the RPA and why I thought your creation when emerging together was if you have the players together and rally, you really have the power and the essential to do it. And you could start dictating. When you find out that actually the clubs, you know, don't care and don't listen to anybody but each other, you know, I think it's hard. But I agree. I've said to Damien, I've said to people before, I think that it's very hard. You need a much more powerful RPA, but the players have to be invested and you have to get some independence away from that. And you also need a counter-organisation to organise the clubs because otherwise they just circumnavigate anything. And I'm in agreement with you. And, I joked about it. I just think that they're hamstrung either way. And I think, you know, coming out and saying they agree with the clubs, I mean, what other choice do you have? I mean, because everybody has to agree with them.
Yeah, that was why we basically went down the legal route and sort of tried speaking to lawyers and doing it ourselves because we were like, well, if no one's going to be sort of wholly fighting our corner, then running uphill, aren't we? So
it's going to happen by the 8th of August or whenever, whenever you said the season's going to start, right?
15th.
This is going to rumble on. Talks, disparity. Clubs are going to individually sort this out. They'll do whatever. Lads are going to sign new deals. And when it comes back into the season and load of lads will be
forgotten
fucked,
about it.
Well, it will be. Loads of lads will be fucked off. Guys will be getting new deals better. And what will happen is, first meeting, captain of the squad will go, right, lads, we've had all that shit with the pay cuts. We've had everything like that. We need to win games. We need to focus. We'll have no talk about that. And I promise to God, it'll be like it never, ever happened. And if you bring it up, you'll be derailing performance. You'll be derailing this. The coaches will say, listen, lads, I know you've been having problems with the club, but we've got to play so-and-so this weekend. That's how professional sports work. If you bring it up, so if Ellis does what he does now in season, distraction, negative, get him out of squad, wrong, head's not on the game, not performing, gone. And he will be seen as a catalyst to destructive thought. So what will happen because he's a good man and because lads are team players, when they get into the season, no player will talk about it. Everyone will accept what's ever happened to them and it will just carry on and will never change. Because everyone's head down, arse up, carry on. And that's what will happen.
Correct.
Should we book in for this in 12 months' time, 24 months' time, 36 months' time?
Hopefully, like you said, a fucking billionaire swoops it all up by then. And that's genuine. If any billionaires do watch your podcast, please come and sort everything out. Because as sick as it is, money does make the world go round, doesn't it?
Right, let's take a deep breath. I just can't believe this is our 100th show. Si has messaged to tell me, and I just can't believe we are locked into this conversation again. Just hoping somewhere somehow we get a bit of a resolution sooner rather than later. Let's do a mid-show trail. In the meantime, coming up, we'll talk more with Ellis on statues and what our game can do in the fight against racism. It gets lighter, I can assure you. You're listening to and watching House of Rugby on Joe together with Guinness, with me, Alex Payne, alongside Hask and the ledge that is Ellis Genge. Don't forget to check out our House of Rugby short series every Friday, 20 minutes or so of straight rugby chat with a different guest each week. We drop down to the Championship in the latest edition with Liam Burnett, assistant manager of London Scottish, to talk about Romanian defectors, having the league's smallest budget, and what impact Saracens will have in the second tier. And the new episode of Sports Pages is also out this week as well, the podcast that digs into the stories behind some of the greatest sports books ever written. This week with Bill Barich and the 40th anniversary of Laughing in the Hills, about a year spent at a Californian race course. Have a listen to this.
When I got back to California after my mother had died, I came back for the funeral, and I was thinking about this book of nonfiction. I was also reading Renaissance philosophy, And there's a notion that one way to understand the big world is to take a look at the little world. And I thought, well, the racetrack is really sort of a microcosm. It's confined. The people sort of live there in a unique and very individual way. And putting that together with the idea that something was going on there, something about the animals, too, and the kind of conjoining of the human and the animal fascinated me. And I thought, okay, well, I'll put together a proposal and I'll write a sample chapter. And let's see what happens. And to my amazement, I got a contract for very, very little money. But it was the fact that I knew the book would be published if it were good enough. It also contributed to being harder on myself. I can't mess around anymore. You know, this is for real. So no more, you know, you don't make anything up. You have to really put in the effort because you may never write another book. And not only that, nobody may even read this, but you got to make it as good as you can.
Brill. So that was Bill Barrich on this week's Sports Pages podcast, which is out now. I'll tell you what, Ellis, just off the back of the conversation we've just had, it is the greatest work experience you will ever have, trying to set up a union and taking on power brokers. So whatever your next venture is, stick me down for a little bit of an investment. Do you mind if we move on to, and I'm sort of, a lot of people come to this podcast because, you know, it's a bit of an escapist hour in the week. There are some huge issues across the world right now, and I don't know how any of us, Hask and I, et cetera, are ever able to make any sense of them or offer anything that's in any way intelligent to the conversation. But, you know, this week, we're obviously, you know, sport is a great escapist route for so many people. And here we are talking about politics in sport. But I'm also fascinated because of some of the other conversations you've been involved with recently, particularly with the statue of Edward Colston being pulled down in your hometown of Briz as well. Can you just quickly sort of reflect on that and your view on it and I suppose the story that's going on in this country at the moment?
Yeah, obviously, as I think everyone's aware now, there was the slave trader called Edward Colston, who obviously done a lot of, I guess you can say, good things for the city, built a lot of buildings, economically very good, but at the end of it, he was a slave trader. So there's a big statue of him near the centre of Bristol, and it was quite daunting if you did know what the bloke was about and sort of his morals to have that statue, because you wouldn't have a statue of a figurehead that done that. I'm just trying to think, well, I don't want to compare him to people. Anyway, we'll stay away from that. Yeah, so basically, obviously, with all the riots going on with the George Floyd stuff, which is terrible, and then the BLM, the Black Lives Matter stuff, I think these... It started off as like a real peaceful protest. And then I think 10 years ago was the first time, 2020, 2010, or maybe 2007, they basically put something out to the council saying, can we remove this statue? And that's, to my knowledge, I'm not 100%. Can we remove this statue of Edward Colston, the slave trader? They pushed it off for years and years. And yeah, during the protest, I guess they all walked past. I wasn't there. And they pulled it down, and like I had so much heat for it. All I asked was rename Colston School, and it was put a question mark at the end of it, Alex, which means it was a question. I wasn't actually implying anything. Everyone was saying, you're adding smoke to the fire, you're being so unhelpful with your platform, you should push it. Fuck off. I'll do with my platform as I please. And it was like, obviously, what a day for the Black lives in general. Like, they making such good progress and all the protests, and you've seen all the stuff that was going on, and then people actually wanted this fucking statue of this slave trader to stay up in the middle of Bristol. I just thought, why would you want that? It's beyond me. And then they rolled it into the water, and my cousin made some quite funny shirts saying, find an Edward Colston, would like find the Nemo background. So I've got one of them on the way. But in terms of my political standpoint on it, I'm not for the violence. And as you've seen, all the people going around to defend the statues and that, and everyone was getting battered and stabbings. And do you know what I mean? It was horrible. I don't like watching that sort of stuff. But I'm all for people protesting and standing up for their rights. As you know, I'm quite vocal about my own. So I thought it was brilliant, people going out protesting, actually trying to make a difference and a positive note for once. But then in the same breath again, I was getting a bit fucked off people doing it for the clout and sort of just making problems that didn't need to be there. But again, that's not my area of expertise, and opinions are like assholes. Everyone's got one, and that's mine.
I've got a few stats. Producer Size dug out a few stats. Paul Hull, a legend, obviously, of Briz and a very fine England fullback as well. The only black director of rugby or head coach in the history of England's top flight, having been in charge of Bristol between 2009 and 2011. Joe Shaw, the Saracen skills and attack coach, is the only homegrown BAME senior coach currently employed in the Premiership. There are no BAME members on the 14-strong RFU board, and of the 55 RFU council members, Maggie Alfonsi, a World Cup winner and an absolute icon in the game, is the only black representative. Does rugby have a racism problem?
I've answered your own question, haven't you? Listen, I think actually I've had a lot of messages off some of my friends saying that they quite sort of conscious how they've made me feel in the past and when they've sort of dished out a bit of crack about it, because I'm not 100% sure where my heritage is from. I've took a lot of ancestry tests and we've had all different results, so you can't really pinpoint it, because my granddad was adopted, so we weren't 100% sure, and they've sort of dished a few jokes out about that, and obviously they felt very guilty after all this stuff came out. And I said, listen mate, like, for me on a personal note, I'm fine with what you've said to me in the past. You've never tried to provoke me, you've been offensive, but within reason. It's just banter for boys. I'm not saying racism banter by any means. What I'm saying is that boys dish out, your breath stinks, you got a terrible lid, Hask, I'm literally aiming all this at you. Some boys say things that they don't mean, and at the time you think, fucking hell, he's just said this, he said that, or he's implied that, and it's just the way sort of civilizations, it does need to change to a certain extent. Like you just read out those stats, that's clear, not an issue. If they're all doing a brilliant job, fine, but I'm sure a lot of those people are just picking up a paycheck and there could be someone of ethnic minority knocking on the door or isn't getting the opportunity because they're BAME. But if that's the case, then that's a massive problem. But these people could be doing good jobs. That's my problem with everyone sort of saying, fucking hell, he doesn't employ any black people. Well, these people might be doing a brilliant job and there might not be any room for them to work. But like Hass, for example, when I first met you, you'd sort of mimic me and impersonate me in the way I spoke, because I'm completely different to you. I'm very aware of that. A lot of people would have seen that as racist. They would have, for whatever reason. I didn't. And then people would say to me, you're gonna let him speak to you? Like, if you were in my neck of the woods, you wouldn't do it, because for numerous reasons. But in that environment, that's just the way it operates at the moment. And you have to... I mean, if you stood up and sort of made a massive campaign every single time you thought someone was implying something to do with your race, you'd be here all fucking day. So that's my stance on it. But yeah, Paul Hole, I was lucky enough to work with Paul, hell of a bloke. Done my first pre-season there when I was 16, I think it was. And he basically was a DOR at the time, lovely bloke. And Joe Shaw, yeah, I spoke to Joe a bit. He's a nice bloke and he's good mates with Sean Marston or whatever, Bristol. But they're all lovely blokes. But yeah, like you said, it seems to be a bit concerning, doesn't it, when there's a severe lack of ethnicity in those coaching roles. But then you ask yourself, is rugby a classist sport? I wouldn't say it's massively racist. I'd say it's probably classist, and the numbers don't lie. I think a lot of the sort of problems we have is classism as opposed to racism. But that's, again, my 10 pence on it.
Can we just clear it up, Alex, before someone comes and bricks my house down? I took the piss out of nothing to do with this race. If Bristol is a race...
That's what I said. I did not say...
Hey, it's nothing to do with... When he talks about mannerism, it's because he takes like this. All right, Barbara, everything okay? Change your lanes, Ari, fair play. That's not fucking racism, Genji. That's because you've got a hanging Bristolian accent. I love people from Bristol. All the way to go around, yeah.
Racist, I think you've ever met, mate. People are purple and you're still fucking boring to death.
That's very true. Or try and sleep with them.
Just to chip in with a 2p piece here. So I actually got challenged about 18 months ago from the then head of Sky Sports, who said, how do we make rugby union coverage more diverse? And I wasn't expecting the question, and it slightly sort of came from left field. And what I did find myself saying is that, so the first game of rugby I ever watched was 1988, England against Ireland. I could tell you the score, but I won't. But Chris Oatey, whose birthday it is today, a legend of English rugby, he scored a hat-trick. And what I found myself saying was, you know, I think the game has changed hugely. You talk about classist. I think it's far more open now than it's ever been. But also, if you compare 2003, and, you know, arguably Jason Robinson would be the guy who stood out in that team, to 2019 and the side that made the World Cup final, which is a far more sort of representative team across the spectrum of Britain today, or of England today, obviously, not only in terms of race and colour, but also in terms of class, etc. So I suppose to Hask, really, do you feel and can you see change coming in rugby that is representative of England today?
Yes.
Has the game still got problems?
It's a very difficult topic for me to cover because I firmly have white privilege. I'm fully aware of that. I think this country, the beauty of the UK is ethnic diversity, is the fact that we welcome everybody and we have such a diverse culture. And I think the England team now, you know, does display that. We actually didn't ever talk about it on air, but Ellis made some comments about that. You know, he's got some people on a building site who are, you know, there's a lot of people on building sites, you know, were more talented than, you know, rugby players, you know, that were currently playing, but weren't afforded the opportunities. And I would say that I think the game is more classist than any issues around race. But what I will say, the caveat to that is comprehensive schools and others, they don't play rugby. So when you look at it, where the opportunities are, there are your local rugby clubs, which are full of diversity and characters of the game. But because sometimes the promotional ability for those from local rugby clubs, Div 17 to whatever, to get up to the England team is sort of a harder journey. And, you know, you look at how the kids get into the young age group stuff. Well, there's the public school system, but, you know, if kids aren't playing in comprehensive, I think trying to make the game more understandable, more available and more diverse into places where it's different classes would attract more people. Unfortunately, I think we inherit where we sow our oats and where it is. And I don't think it's intentional, but, you know, rugby isn't as popular as people in rugby think it is. So everybody loves football. Everybody wants to play football. Every school plays football. Hardly any school plays rugby. And now because of, you know, issues around concussion, more schools are sacking it off. So it's only going to get a smaller pool, I think, which is interesting. That's just my view.
I completely understand where you're coming from. But then on the same note, do you think the reason in that class division, the lower end of that, would you say the reason they aren't playing it is because the way the system is built or the way the people in the system are? I know what you said when you said the system makes you that way and you sow your oats and stuff. But if you look at football and all the stories that come out of football, and everyone can relate to it so well, whereas you look at rugby and all these people who went to these amazing schools which give people such good opportunities, I can never fucking relate to that. It actually made me really angry that those people were getting those opportunities and I wasn't. And then you look at the age grade system. I don't know what it's like now, but definitely for a fact, when I was younger, it was England schools. Only 16, sorry. Everything else was England rugby, 17s, England 18s. Yeah. But why the fuck was it England schools? My school wasn't even contacted on my England
I think partly you've answered the question because I think the structure, like the England schools thing, England under 18s, all those kind of stuff, the accessibility of who was open, like you saying your school wasn't approached, right? I'll say that when I played at Maidenhead Rugby Club, I played there from the age of 5 to 18. All the way through that, I'm still, you know, going off playing after school in games. I play on a Saturday and go and play on a Sunday. I mean, that's probably why I can't walk downstairs now. But the diversity of players I was playing with then is that when I was younger, I mean, I've developed a bit of a Mockney geezer accent, but I was, you know, public school, Berkshire, the antithesis of everything you're talking about and the complete opposite to you, Ellis, you know. But I was playing with guys from, you know, a different class system and they had the access. Whether I was given preferential treatment because of where I came, I can't tell you, because I'll say that after hopefully 77 caps, I proved that I was possibly the right man for the job. I can't say that whether the people in the position, the selectors, don't look down because I've not been there. All I can say is I think the structure doesn't allow it. And I think that the fact that schools don't play it doesn't allow it. But I think rugby clubs, I was playing with guys that couldn't have been more different than me. And I, do you know what? So when I did a trial for England under 16s, I went down to the Midlands. I was basically in the Southwest. Southwest had too many number eights. I went up to the Midlands. Mate, day one, I turned up to the Midlands. Can you imagine what those lads thought of me? They were, I was honest to God, it was the most, and it was the most uncomfortable kind of 6 months of my life where I was literally, I was going to say bullied, but I was like, I was the fucking odd one out. I was the public school person. Everybody else was kind of working class in that young England team. Very different than I was. And so I think there is obviously potential for an inherent view of, look, we'll promote with our own. You know, I'm blue blood. He's got to be blue blood. Let's do that. But I would say it's more the structure and the availability of rugby, because I think if people were given proper opportunities and club rugby was, there was actually much more of a feeding thing like they have in New Zealand, the importance of the club rugby, whereas if you don't play for WASP one weekend, you're off playing for your local rugby club. I think that would promote more people access to it, I think. But I think I can't rule out If the face don't fit, if the fucking car doesn't look good enough, if your parents don't own a business, you know, I'm sure that happens. I'm sure that happens, you know, more so than it should. But I think the structure is what fucks it.
Yeah. It's interesting you said about the, you felt really uncomfortable going to the Midlands, because I was in the Southwest one. And when I went to the camp, it was like the first time I ever stayed away from my home in Bristol. If I wasn't sleeping at a mate's house or doing whatever I was doing, it was the first time I stayed in like a hotel on my own. Fucking hell, weird. And I was actually rooming with Tom Howe, who you probably know quite well from Wasps, hell of a boy. And again, probably got a very upper class upbringing, legend. Can't speak highly enough of Tommy. Bit of a space cadet, but what a boy. And I think he was off getting yogurt and granola or whatever. He was having a snack. He was into his nutrition from the age of fucking three, like, hell of a rig. And I sat in the room for about 20 minutes. I was like, fucking hell, I'm so bored. I'm going to go see what the other boys are doing. So I've gone around, like, knocking. Maybe it was quite weird, actually, now I look back on it. I was, like, knocking on the other... on the other boys' doors, and I've, like, sort of heard three or four voices in one room, and I knocked, and I was like, yo, and I had no reply. Yo, that knock, and again, I had a spoon in my hand because I had a yogurt as well. Tommy brought me back a yogurt. So I was going around and see what the boys were doing, and I heard them all go quiet and start whispering. I thought, fucking hell, that's weird. They wouldn't let me in their room, wouldn't speak to me, these boys. I had no idea why. And one of the boys came to the door, can't remember his name, but he, I was like, what are you doing? He was like, I'm just finishing off some A-level artwork. Even like fucking A-levels work. I did, I'm joking. And I was like, oh, sweet, can I come in? Again, looking back on it, it's quite fucking weird. Can I come in and fucking play dolls? But yeah, I was like knocking on this door, basically trying to like integrate with these boys, and they didn't want to have any of it. So I obviously took that to offense, and there was like four of them in there. So I went to my door, which was opposite theirs, coincidentally, and I was looking through the peephole, and then one of them fucking opened the door and like basically looked around at that, and I could see all the boys behind him like going, is he there? Is he there? So like that's obviously the other side of the coin. Where you felt, it's interesting, because you felt really awkward going to the Midlands, which traditionally is a bit of a sort of poorer part of the country, to the London areas and stuff. Obviously, South West isn't London, it's South East. But yeah, I had a completely different experience with you. If you would have went to that South West one, you would have been fucking right as rain. If I would have went to the Midlands one, I'd have been fucking on fire. So
I've got two questions. Do you think that shaped how you were when I first met you in England camp, and how you've been since in rugby, where... You know, like we joked when you came on the show, you wanted to punch me in the face, but you thought, who's this fucking guy? Because I talked to you straight away. You know, I was talking to you, engaging, but you were quite standoffish. Do you think that's dictated how you were because of that?
Yeah, absolutely. When everyone's so nice, especially when you get to a professional game, because, and in England as well, because no one really has any worries to a degree. Obviously, you've got your stuff away from the pitch, but it's sort of your getaway, and it's your sanctum when you're with the boys and you're having coffee and you're fucking throwing Lego at each other. But, like, you come in and I was like, fucking hell, why is everyone being so nice to me? Like, what do these people want? And that was why I had that sort of defence mechanism, because I never really had that. I was obviously accepted by Bristol very well, purely because I thought, like, I was a Bristolian. I was sort of salt of the earth, you know what I mean? I was part of the furniture. I was at the club. And I come to Leicester, I was the exact same, very sort of didn't speak to many people. And, yeah, I guess it was. But I wouldn't say it was that one sole moment that shaped
it. No.
I remember I knocked on their door again like in an hour and had a cup of water with me. And when he opened the door, I fucking flew all the water into the room. And it ruined his A-level artwork. But it was his fault because he didn't let me in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you also, first of all, the reason you accepted Bristol is that anyone gave you a new lip, you punched them right in the face, because you told us that the other day. So, you know, I mean, you're hardly someone, you know, I'd be nervous if I saw you standing in the corridor, size of you holding a yogurt spoon, thought you might want to scoop my eye out. Do you remember how bad those school system stuff was? That almost, 16s and 18s almost put me off rugby for life, those experiences.
Yeah. I remember it very well. My mum and dad did as well. It was literally, I was coming home from the things. I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. I really do not want to be here. I'm not enjoying it. I don't get on with these boys. They won't accept me. They won't speak to me. I'm bored. I'm in my hotel room. Chat to Tom Howe, for fuck's sake. he's a legend. But yeah, those are some of the challenges. And I guess it could have been very different, couldn't it? I could have just thought, fuck it, I'm not doing it anymore, which a lot of my friends did. Thought, I'm not doing this. This isn't the way I want to be treated. And just can it, but luckily I stuck with it.
Did you stick with it, or did your mum say get back out there and
no,
keep
it was
going?
My dad. It was more so my dad sort of, he used to, my dad's a man of few words, but when he does speak, I listen. And he said to me, like, just think how good it'll feel when you've sort of beat the system. and not you never make it, do you? Because once you've done one thing, you want to do another. You want to get better all the time. That's Eddie rubbing off on me. You do, don't you? You always want to get better. So it's not a case of made it. But once you sort of beat that system and get to where you aim to be, your goal. Because my dad said to me, it was a bit of a driver. He was like, one day we came back from a trial and I didn't get in. I think it was a Southwest one to get into England schools. And he was like, well, that's it, mate. You better fucking pack it in, get on the tools. You're never going to make it. And I was like, fucking hell. And I was a weird kid, mate. That stuck with me. That burnt so fucking hard. So then from then on in, because I didn't go to school between, I think it was before 12 o'clock, I had to turn up at 12 o'clock or I had to leave at 12 o'clock. It was different each week for whatever reason. So I only done 3 lessons, maths, English and science. And then like picked up my BTEC in my own time. And I used to go to the gym and I remember just literally no music, nothing, just fucking thinking about him saying that every single time. So I had a bit of a head start and maybe that was it. I was going to the gym fucking 4 hours every day at the age of 15.
How funny is that? It's like everything we've talked about is the comparisons and the complete opposite. It's like sliding doors. Because what happens when I didn't get into England under 16s? I got all the way to the final trial. I didn't do any of the training, extra training I was supposed to do because they put all this pressure on you to do it. I was just playing rugby for fun. I was tall but really skinny, didn't do any extra training, got to the final trial, didn't get in, got a phone call and told, you're not in. And I was a kid with a privileged background, silver spoon up my ass, or whatever the expression is. You know, you find it, I cried like a baby. And I remember calling my dad up and I said to him, you know, I don't want to do this. I was devastated. I had everything, and it's been easy in my life to a certain degree. And he said to me, the opposite was, he said, listen, you can either see this as an opportunity, you can either see this as an opportunity to come back better, to go and do the work, because you know you didn't put it in, you know you didn't do the training, and come back and show them and stick 2 fingers up, or you can just play rugby and give up. And that was the sole motivation. I got a guy that used to be a family friend, he was a personal trainer, and I trained with him twice a week, every week, for a year and a half. And like a Rocky montage, I got bigger, quicker, stopped drinking, stopped doing any of these kind of things that I was ever doing, you know. And I got into England under 18s and ended up captaining it. And that, for me, is what kept me and has helped me with every other success in life, because I was like, fuck it. If someone says I can't do it, I'm going to prove them wrong. And it's like a different ways of getting there, but it's the same goal.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we're brothers separated at birth, Ellis. Maybe that's what happened.
My lid is not as wispy as that, my boy. You should never speak 1,000 words.
Your chat's not as good as either, so it's vice
versa. Very true. Maybe I got the lid, you got the genetics.
Yeah, I got the rig. I got the rig and the chat.
It's been absolutely fascinating listening to the two of you discuss this, and I've sort of loved being a backseat passenger. I hope in some ways we've done it justice. I dread to think that we haven't. But the question I sort of want to finish with is, and I've spoken about this with Hask before, is that actually sportsmen don't want to be role models and heroes. And I think that's probably in a sporting context. But when you look at the likes of Raheem Sterling and the incredible work that Marcus Rashford's been doing recently, I just wonder whether actually, you know, and Marrow has spoken very passionately about it. He said, I think as a black person in a white society, eventually you realise that you're always going to be in the minority. Whether you're going to church, whether you're going to school, whether you're going shopping, you look around and you just know that you are the other. Are you more accepting, I suppose, of the role that you play and the voice that you have in these much bigger issues? Does that sit more easily with you in some ways than the kids who just idolise you as a rugby player?
That's a tough question. I don't think I've ever been asked that in such detail as well. And I don't want to not upset, but dishearten any kids who, if they do idolise me, perfect. But I've always said, and I'll stand by it, is you just be yourself, man. Like, because that's what's going to help you sleep at night. That's what's going to help you enjoy your life away from rugby. It's not the fucking end of the world. Like, rugby is not the end of the world by any means. And if you want to be like me, great, but at the same time, don't forget who you are. And that's one thing I'll always hold on to, is at the end of my career, I'm never going to look back and say I'd done this because I had to do or be like this to please this bloke. And obviously you have to play the game to a certain degree, as everyone does, there's rules everywhere, but Maz speaks passionately in that sense. And at the moment, I just try to be myself as much as I can. And if some people, Eddie says it to me, those boys look up to you, mate. And I say, yeah, fucking hell, brilliant. And that's for being myself. So if I'm a gateway for boys from and girls from my upbringing to play professional sport or to do well in life, whatever it is, to get out of fucking bed in the morning, to get your BTECs, then brilliant. But if not, then yeah, I won't lose any sleep over it. It's not something I wake up every morning and think, fucking hell, I've got to be the best role model I can today, because everyone makes mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. And yeah, as long as you're I don't want to be so fucking cringy and cliche, but as long as you stay, I'm not going to say it. You know exactly what I was going to say.
I know what you mean. Don't go changing. You're a very easy man to follow, and I have huge respect for you for, you know, for what you're doing. And I imagine you're an absolute pain in the ass for some seriously sort of high-powered officials, but keep doing it, you know. And I hope at some point we'll end up talking about greater things and happier times and more balanced things, Hask. I mean, it's sad that this show has been what it is, because it means that things aren't right. But I hope in some ways we've tried to do it justice. Certainly it's been a very interesting viewpoint.
I think the beauty of the House of Rugby is that every show is different. Every show is a roller coaster. Sometimes it's a laugh fest, sometimes it's serious. I think, you know, the reason I contacted Ellis, because, you know, I think he's worked very hard and tried to create something. I think he speaks truth. And in a world of where people are afraid to speak, where it's a 2020 default mode, I'm offended, change my mind, I think it adds real clarity. And I think there is so much exciting stuff about Ellis and his future. You know, I think there's going to be some more questions raised after this podcast. I think hopefully we're going to get someone on from the RPA to put, you know, their version on it. I think there are especially dialogue to come. And I think we're going to have, you know, big Nigel Owens on to finish what has been an incredible second series. And I think I've loved doing this show with Ellis. I've loved sharing it. I think I've got so much time for the guy. And hopefully people who watch it, they loved it first time. I think they'll love it and see more a more diverse side. They're probably not going to like his shit earphones, his dodgy hat, and his terrible chair. But, you know, apart from that, it should be fine.
Will Carlin, what a boy. Yeah, boys, I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
Good man. Look after yourself, keep doing what you're doing, and hopefully we'll see you trotting around the paddock with a back in one piece before too long, Ellis Riledge. Ladies and gents, that is it for this week. Another roller coaster on House of Rugby brought to you by Joe, together with our very good friends at Guinness. Don't forget, you can dig into our back catalogue. That's available on podcast or on YouTube. And you can talk about your favourite shows and your bits and pieces in the Facebook group as well. Don't forget to download Sports Pages. That's the interview podcast from Joe this week with Bill Barrage, author of a true sporting classic, Laughing in the Hills. Thank you to Hask. Thank you once again to Ellis. Look after yourself. See you on Friday for House of Rugby Shorts with a Difference, as we welcome back, as Hask said, Nigel Owens for a second tilt in our final show of the series. Until then, look after yourselves. We'll be seeing you.
Big Nigel.
You've been listening to the House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.co.uk for the facts.